Open the House Committee on Human Services on Friday, April 10th, 2009, and we're going to carry over until Monday, House Bill 2897, 3466, and 2413. And I will open up a hearing on House Bill 2144. Work session. Thank you. I'm opening up the work session on House Bill 2144. Keeley?
This bill instructs the Department of Education, the Oregon Youth Authority, the Department of Human Service, and the State Commission on Children and Families to take part in developing an integrated system of care to facilitate a planning process for youth at risk of developing emotional behavioral or substance use-related needs, their families and community, and natural supports to provide a flexible group of services and a customized plan for each youth, reflecting their needs, values, and preferences. The committee amendment, which is the -2 amendment, we're being asked to adopt, defines in detail the family, what a family-run organization is, the identified population, partner agency, and services support, and establishes core values and principles of the wraparound initiative.
Great. Thank you. And colleagues, we had first started hearing this bill way back in February, and there was some question about wraparound services, so we were sent a two-page reminder of what wraparound services were and what they do, and so I think we are ready to pass this bill. So have we already adopted the -2 amendments?
No, we need to adopt those first. And
so, Madam Chair, I move to adopt the House Bill 2144, the -2 amendments, dated March 31st, 2009.
Okay. Representative Olson moves to adopt the House Bill 2144 with the -2 amendments, dated March 31st. Any discussion? All right. Would you please call the roll, Zach?
Representative Van Orman.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
I don't know.
Excused.
Representative Dimbro.
Aye.
Representative Cowan.
Aye.
There he is.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. Representative Freeman is here, and he would like to vote. Say aye.
Aye.
Having received the required majority, House Bill 2144 passes.
You know, Madam Chair, that's the best arm twisting.
We just stopped the amendments. I'm sorry. We just adopted
that was just the amendment.
Yeah, okay. All right. Let's do this again. All right. All right. Representative.
Well, Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2144 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2144 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any
need to ask that the subsequent referral be removed.
And the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Any discussion?
Okay.
Any objections?
That answers my question. Thank you.
Yep.
Yes, Representative.
We've had questions about this, about the wraparound, and just in personal meetings about the need to put it in legislation, and other places are doing it, and taking the physical out certainly changes, makes it a lot easier to deal with. But I don't want to put Representative Freeman on the spot, but I know he had some comments.
I have a few comments to make, and I apologize for being late. Thanks, Chair Tomei. I had an opportunity to talk to my county, and I know other people talk to their counties, and our county already does this. They do it with 17 different agencies, including the parents and the children involved. A few concerns I got back from them was that each county does it a little bit differently, and they were a little bit afraid of setting one template, how they all had to do it the same, since each county has different resources. And at times they have different resources, and kids at different times need different types of help. So they were just a little bit cautious of the bill. Going through the bill, the word shall appears 21 times. So it would make you feel when you read the bill that this wasn't already being done. when in fact, I think in most cases, or at least a lot of cases, it is being done. So I'm probably going to vote against it, but only because it's already being done, and I don't think there's a need to have a statewide pattern or you know, way to do it when each community probably has the ability to do it a little bit better their way.
You know what I'm going to do? Did I see
Jen Mickey? Allen?
Jen, yeah, come on up and help us deal with this.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Jane Ellen Whitehands with the Addictions and Mental Health Division, Department of Human Services. And Representative Freeman is correct that certain communities, through federal grants that were available to local community mental health programs, were able to institute these wraparound initiatives. And his community was one of those communities that took advantage of the opportunity that the federal government put on the table. The bill before you today is very specific to state agencies, and the intent was to the executive order that the governor had passed that started this in 2007 for state agencies has expired. And what this basically does is says we're not there yet. We're not totally we have not broken down all of the barriers for families and for children, and we need as a state to continue that on into the future until those barriers are broken down and we look at services specifically for that individual and their family to meet their needs and really continuing to work together in a collaborative process at the state level. So there is no specific mandate to local communities. We're hoping through breaking down the barriers at the state level that local communities can follow suit and can wrap around and help families more appropriately without categorically mandated populations, without all the barriers and hoops that we make families jump through today.
Thank you, Jane Ellen. And I just want to tell you also about the experience that I've had in my 9 years here being in the legislature. And over the years, this is what we've heard from families, from parents of children who are needing these services. And they keep talking about wraparound services so that they don't go to one agency for one level of care, another agency for another level of care, another agency for another. They sort of want a one-stop shopping center where they can get wraparound services for their child and not have to go to different places to get those same services. So I think you're very fortunate that in your community you have had that. But I think what we're trying to do is provide this for our whole state. So, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a yes vote. I support wraparound. It makes sense. It's I guess it's something we have to do. It's kind of a shame that we have to tell people to work together for the benefit of the constituent or the client because of the barriers and the turf wars and stuff. That frustrates me. I mean, it should be common sense. We should be doing what's best for the constituent. One additional note, it was mentioned in the public hearing, although it was subtle, and I would like to recommend to the agency, department, whatever, that anytime anything's being presented to me, I would like all of the intentions to be a little more overt and on the table. I'm going to walk away from here firmly believing that what we're doing is setting up the infrastructure not only for a good program called Wraparound, but we're setting the stage for an ask in 2 years coming back to fund this program. And I don't think anybody would deny that. But what I don't think is fair is that we're going to pass this pretty much knowing that that's going to be the intent without having any idea of what it's going to take 2 years from now, what the ask is going to be. And I think it's going to be significant. And I would just, and that can be refuted on the record also. I just wanted to go on the record stating that I think that's what's going to happen. And I think we just need to know that. Now, am I saying it's not worth it? No, not at all. I just think that we need to understand that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Huffman. Any further discussion?
Madam,
yes.
I comment to Representative Huffman's comment?
Please.
Is that it can't cost any more than the dysfunction that we have today. And so, you know, if they come back with a big ask, then the retort is, what have you fixed, or what are you going to fix to make this a zero-sum game, because bureaucracies build themselves, the turf becomes so entrenched that we can't change, and we need to shake the tree. And rewarding them with more resources without having really shaken the tree is not acceptable.
And that's one of the things that we do in the Ways and Means Subcommittee.
But some of us aren't there.
I know.
That's why we shake over here. We shake at a distance.
Any further discussion? All right. Thank you, committee. Now, Zach, would you take any more questions of our witness here? Seeing none? Zach, you take the roll, please.
Representative Cowan.
Aye.
Representative Denver.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Representative Van Orden.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair
Tomei. Aye. Having passed the required majority, House Bill 2144 passes. Anyone want to volunteer to carry this? Representative Van Orman, thank you. All right. Close the public or the work session on House Bill 2144 and open a public hearing.
Work session.
I'm sorry, work session
Gelser would
on
like to
2442. Representative Gelser, I almost skipped you. Representative Gelser.
No comments. 2442.
Colleague, we do have a fiscal on 2442. You want to tell us about that, Keely?
Actually, Representative Gelser probably could discuss the fiscal
most
better, more effectively than I could.
You look pretty reticent to come up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Sarah Gelser. Thank you again for hearing this bill and hopefully moving it on to Ways and Means today. I do not have the fiscal right in front of me this morning, but my understanding is that the general fund for 09-11 is approximately $255,000, which was approximately what I had shared with you during the work session when you adopted the amendments. That covers the cost of maintaining the database once it is up and running. The fiscal indicates the other funds. If you'll remember, that quality care fund that brings money in pays for that initial development of the website, and then it also pays for some additional staff in the Office of Investigations and Trainings around protective services. Clearly this bill doesn't go to the floor. It has a fiscal. It goes to Ways and Means, but I do think it is a bill that's worthy of the consideration of the Subcommittee on Human Services of Ways and Means as we move forward, and I hope that you will send it forward, and thanks for all of your work on this bill over the course of more than 18 months.
Thank you, Representative Gelson. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was under the impression that the fiscal was higher than $255,000.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, the total fund fiscal is higher. The general fund fiscal is approximately 255. I don't have it right in front of me, so I know that there's another number that's in there. It's in that $255,000 range for general fund. The other funds total is higher because if you'll remember, the bill brings in additional money in fines and civil penalties, and licensing fees, and that pays for the implementation and development of that website. So those other funds are also in that fiscal. So when you see that number at the bottom, that's inclusive of those other funds in the general fund.
Follow up. We've been waiting a long time for the fiscal, and I'd like to see it. I'd like to know what the number is.
I'm sorry. I thought I had copies here. No, we can suspend for just a minute, and because I printed copies off, and I'm sitting here looking for them going, I'm not
okay.
Sure what happened.
We will recess until Keely is able to find them. the work session on 2442 again. So, colleagues, do you want to look at this for a minute? And do you have questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
May I?
Please.
So you'll see that the number, I said 255,000, it's 255,513 for the general fund. The total other funds is 369,111, and again, that's the setup for the total funds of 624,624. And that in that other funds, that is a one-time cost. The general fund then rolls up. The way that you know that the dollars come in for those other funds is in one of the amendments that you adopted, the highest number. I think it was the dash 9. That changed the implementation date of the database to allow time for the change in the licensing fees so that money would fill the fund to be able to pay for the development of the website.
Colleagues, the process for this, it would go on to Ways and Means, and Ways and Means would be looking at this very thoroughly.
Yes, Madam Chair, I get the message.
Yes.
Subtle, wasn't it?
You want your motion now?
Yeah, I do.
Madam Chair, I move HB 2442. As amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Boone moves House Bill 2442 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and that it be referred on to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion?
No, someone else was first.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I still have some problems with this. I have told the Chair I would give this a courtesy vote out of this committee. One of my main problems is, and although I realize I've talked with Representative Gelser and others about what this does compared to what wasn't in place, and I still have a problem with limiting the amount of fines that we can charge, that the department can charge, to send a very strong message to people when something very egregious and serious happens, such as a rape or a murder. And it kind of, it just rings of this, you know, that costs that much. And if it's a big company, they can just write it off and write a check and it's done. And it just, to me, that, I just think it kind of cuts them off at the feet. And it's troublesome for me. I know you've worked very hard on this bill, and I know that this is probably in a different situation than we were before, but it still bothers me that that's the situation. And when James Taves told us his side of the story, it rung very true with me. So I just wanted to say that.
Thank you, Representative Huffman.
With Maurer going first? Go ahead.
Yes, thanks.
I yield to the senior member.
And Representative Boone, with all due respect, I do support the cap because I think if you have a real serious incident that the institution company is going to get hammered in other ways. I think their liability is just endless or seemingly endless. My problem is the fiscal. And I could give it a courtesy vote out of the committee, but I don't sit on Ways and Means, so I don't have an opportunity to weigh in on the priority of this amongst all the other things that we're having to deprioritize, unfortunately, in this session. So I would, you know, granting courtesy votes is still a vote, and so I will be a no vote. Just as a cautionary tale to Ways and Means.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you. I do sit on a Ways and Means subcommittee, and we've, over the last couple months, listened to what's going to be cut. Things like Oregon Youth Authority and some of the prosecuting ability and some of the defense ability for indigent defense, and this is a great idea, a great program that should be in place. With the inability to fund what we've been doing, I just can't in good conscience say, okay, you know, we'll let Ways and Means figure it out. I'm going to vote no just because of the cost. And I think there's things we do currently that are priorities that are not going to get funded, and I'm troubled by that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This issue and a number of issues this session have been before my committees that deal with what Representative Boone was talking about on what is the appropriate amount of finable leverage that a department should have. And I think we have to look for that fine line. But I do feel strongly that there needs to be a cap on the punitive authority of the agency, because at some point that's where the courts kick in, and that's where their jurisdiction begins. And if something too treacherous happens, then the license needs to be pulled and those people need to end up in court. And so we just have to find that line.
And I would remind you, colleagues, that as Representative Gelser said, she has been working with all of the stakeholders on this issue for a very, very long time. And as has been said about politics, it's like making sausage. And you do the best you can, and not everybody is 101% happy with what comes out. But I think most people, most of the stakeholders, are very pleased. This is legislation that needs to happen, because there is nothing that in the state now that does what this legislation does. So I would really hope that we can pass this out today so we can have Ways and Means look at it. And I think there are going to be some negotiation Ways and Means and where some of the funding for this will come. Representative Ann Orman?
Well, I would just like probably to echo what you've just said, is that regardless of the funding, does belong with the decisions at Ways and Means, I still think we should be making the statement that it's an important statement to be made, that when people are placed in these facilities, that the state has some protection or some recourse when people are hurt. So I will vote for this in hope that Ways and Means can find something, but because of the complexity of the funding issues, as you said, it could be multiply funded as opposed to just coming out of the general fund.
Right.
Madam Chair, I wanted to just say something. Representative Gilson, you have been like a bumblebee throughout this building, I mean, working on this thing. I mean, you've poured a lot of energy into this, I know, from what the last 18 months have brought. So I just really want to say good job on that. This is a serious issue. But I'm going to have to, you know, agree with my colleagues to this point for the dollar amount as well for my vote right now at this point.
Representative Maurer?
The bumblebee analogy is horrible. It's more like a butterfly.
A butterfly.
There's no sting involved here.
No,
depends on who you talk to.
You don't know her well.
Representative Dembro, did you have...
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I just want to say that, I think getting to the point in the session where we have to think of our role as a policy committee and look at the quality of the legislation, the nature of the program. I think that this, this bill sets up a program that will provide really needed services to the families that are affected here. And I think it's important for us to send that message. What happens to it in the Ways and Means process will be out of our hands, but at least they'll look at this bill and see that this is good policy, and if we can find the money for it, we will fund it. And I think that's our job, and so I feel very comfortable voting yes.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion? All right. Zach, would you call the roll? We made the motion, right? Yes.
No.
Okay. Zach, call the roll, please.
Representative Van Orman.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
No.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Nay.
Representative Dembro.
Aye.
Representative Cowan.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
No.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. Having received the required majority, this bill passes. And so we send it directly to Ways and Means, or would it go to the floor?
I believe it goes directly to Ways and Means.
Okay, right. So we'll go to Ways and Means. Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you very
much. So nobody needs to carry it or do anything more with it, right?
I'm not actually sure.
I'm sure that if it comes out of Ways and Means, Representative Gelser will want to carry it.
Yes.
That would be my assumption.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Actually, it won't. All right. It won't be carried. Okay. It would be put in a 5,000.
We'll be right along.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
you're right. Sorry.
It'd be buckling.
Okay. We will close the work session on House Bill 2442, and I am so glad to get rid of that bill. And we'll open up a public hearing on 2600.
I don't know if anybody has phone
spots.
No,
I
haven't.
Or QA's already
sending
the bill.
Mr. Esterberg is here.
Okay. Keely, would you read us what this bill is about?
House Bill 2600 requires that lodging facilities with 50 or more units provide lift systems for persons with disabilities to allow them to access the bed, toilet, and shower or bath.
Okay. And Representative Freeman, will you tell us what's been going on with your little...
I would. Thank you, Chair Tomei, and thank you for the opportunity to work on this, and I'm going to thank Representative Van Orman for helping me with this right off, because it's what was thought to be a real simple work session we were going to have. The first work session got to be a little more complicated than what we had hoped. We had our first work session and back on April 7th, and we had a good turnout of different folks representing different interests. And our first work session was attended by Representative Van Orman, Jeff Hampton from the lodging industry, Nicole Armstrong, and Todd Kennedy, and then there was a few other folks there. Todd Kennedy, I need to make sure and say, was there representing himself, not the clerk's office, and we did these meetings after work time. That was important for him that I said that. As we went through the list of issues at the first meeting, we attempted to define lift, defined the size of the motels. We wanted to make sure we were covering the whole state without having too many of them. We talked about making sure that the liability was manageable. And there was a couple other things that had come up, and we assigned different people of the work group to try to solve those problems. And then we got back together on April 7th, and we were able to address a few of those issues, but in the meantime, new issues had come up, everything from the agency that would be in charge of regulating and making sure that this was being done, to some architectural concerns that had come up and some site visits that I had made. The disability folks had brought back a pretty good list of different things that would have to be addressed, and it just got a lot bigger. At that meeting, that was this week, we went around the table and we said, okay, I start out with I'll stay here all night and get this solved, whatever it takes. And we went around the table with the likelihood of us being able to get it done this session, and the disability folks and others in the room had indicated that they thought it was going to take longer to solve all these problems. And I know more about lifts and architecture and motel rooms than I ever thought I would know. I could explain as much of that as you'd like. The first thing we had to make sure everybody understood what we were talking about when we said lift wasn't a lift to get somebody upstairs. It wasn't a lift to to do anything other than get people from a wheelchair into a bed, onto a toilet, and into the shower. So we'd hope to try to find one particular type of lift that would do all those things, as opposed to having three different lifts. Mm-hmm. On the third floor, if you guys aren't aware of what lifts are, on the house side in one of the restrooms, there is some lifts. It would take three of those type of lifts to accomplish what we're trying to accomplish in this bill. There's other lifts that are big, long tracks. And if rooms were set up right, you could have one track lift that would do all three things. But there's some architectural stuff that would have to be done and structural stuff that would have to be done to make that work. So it just, our recommendation came back as this is a little bigger than we can solve this quick. Everybody was committed to making sure that we could get it solved and come out with a bill that everybody would like and would work. And that we thought we just needed more time to do that, and we'd like a chance to do that during the interim.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you for taking this on and doing such an excellent job. And you too, Representative Van Orman. Do you have anything to add to that?
No, he's covered it very well. He's done an excellent job.
He has, I know. Mm-hmm. Representative Boone, you had a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to let you know that I had my staff look into part of this too, because I have a travel agent in, she's not in my district, but she's a good friend, and they do specialized trips all over the world, and she has a list of hotels that are, you know, accessible for people with disabilities, but the track or the lift issue is not listed, and that piqued their interest, and they're looking into creating such a database for to add to the whatever it is that, you know, they call the travel agent's assistance book or whatever, of where to send people. Because when she plans her trips, she has people with all ranges of disabilities, and there's always at least one who needs some sort of extra assistance.
Right.
So this has sparked something, and so I think that will be being done in the meantime also.
That's great. Good.
So. Well, I think it has... If I may. Thank you. Excuse me. It has a potential because we are going to have a number of young people coming back who will be in wheelchairs, and that will want some access. So I do think that this is timely, but unfortunately it is a little more complex. And Todd actually did the research to try to find, and he found two hotels in Las Vegas, and the reason they were there was that the owner of the hotels had a friend who was in a wheelchair and specifically set up the rooms to accommodate that individual. But we even had difficulty finding other hotels that had anything like this.
Yeah.
So we may be on the cutting edge of something.
It doesn't hurt my feelings. I think... Nicole, did you have anything? And certainly somebody from Boley, I know you want to speak. Nicole, did you have anything to add to any of this?
No.
Okay. All right. Come on up. We want to hear from Boley, which so, I think Madam is Chair, unanticipated. Just said,
there are two hotels in Las Vegas that have it.
There's two casinos.
Excuse me, two casinos.
4,000 rooms.
How many hotel rooms are there in Las Vegas? Like more than 50?
Yeah. They were, it's like
I mean it's
that's pretty significant.
I was very interested in doing a site visit to make sure that we
I think the whole committee should do
that.
We don't get in trouble. Right. We want to coordinate that.
Thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Bob Estabrook from the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. Our interest in the bill is specifically tied to the location of the statute going into Chapter 659A, which Boley enforces, including civil rights and disability public accommodation law. A concern that came up in that second work group meeting, as the representative indicated, about the most appropriate enforcement mechanism. Boley, of course, handles complaints after the alleged discrimination has already occurred. And in terms of creating the greatest accessibility for individuals, we're not certain that that process necessarily creates the greatest access. But we are very, very interested in being part of this interim process to discuss what the best mechanism for enforcement is. And it certainly would be consistent with our current mission to have Boley involved in that, at least in some way.
Great. Thank you. Any questions of this witness? Thank you so much for coming today. Any other questions or concerns? Input on this, colleagues? All right, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2600. and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2388.
3388.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Yes. I'm sorry. I'm going to close that House Bill hearing on 3388 and reopen the public hearing on 2600. Representative Roland, thank you for coming.
Sorry, I've been in so many meetings that I realized when I saw the phone and saw the TV and I realized I better get down here and say. For the record, Representative Arnie Roland, House District 9 in Coos Bay. As I've listened to the conversation and I've looked at things, the part that has given me the most angst in the conversations is that everything I hear about is the talking about track systems and all this other stuff, and when you build the new building, you have to put all the stuff in. The bill doesn't say that. The bill allows for portable systems. $300-$400, that's all they cost. The people could keep them in a closet in the concierge's office. They wheel it in there if they have a patient. It's better if the floors aren't carpeted, other kinds of stuff, so you can move people around easier with those portable systems. I don't see that they have to do the track systems. Now, it got those conversations happen, but the bill certainly doesn't define that. And in those portable systems, they have a little harness which you're going to attach it to. And we already talked about the fact the people can bring their own harnesses, so there's not an issue with respect to how it fits. It's already there. It's that if you're trying to travel as a handicapped person that's in a wheelchair, bringing that big piece of equipment, because it has a broad base, so it slides under a bed to put you down. It slides over next to the toilet so it can set you there. Again, making the rooms big enough so you can get it in, there would be some minor adjustments that would have to be done if they wanted to use a portable system in these rooms to make it effective. And that's why it was said only groups that are so large and when they're doing reconstruction. Because there are things you can do to make them work. In the high school, all we use are portable systems. We have assistants that come in and pick people up, but they are amazing when you see these portable little systems that wheel around, and you can put a person from here to there. You can lift them up so that if you have to change diapers on people, which you have to do, and some of these kids get to be 200 and 300 pounds. So most schools have these systems in them. They don't have track systems. They have a restroom that's been developed that's nearby that they can move the person to so they can get them on a toilet or put them into a gym shower or whatever they're going to take care of those people. And so what I get concerned about is everybody gets going to the most expensive solution when, in fact, all the bill says is let's figure out a way to have these. And would you maybe have to train your bellhops a little bit more to help and make sure that people, maybe knew how to use the particular piece of equipment? Probably. There would probably be some extra training to do so that the person that's traveling with the person who's handicapped, because they would expect to have their own person that's there to help them. They aren't expecting the hospital to necessarily do that. But the ability to have available at these places this little portable system that can move around and a room that is set up in such a way that that system would work better. As I was saying, linoleum, tile, wood floors are a lot better than having a rug and try to move somebody around. Making sure there's not a big bump between the going into the bathroom and outside the bathroom. Those are kinds of things that I think would have to be done when they're rebuilding their deal. It's not putting a track system that goes all the way from the bed all the way into the bathroom and does all those kind of stuff. And I think there are places, I think you've heard Las Vegas, that has some of those. But that's not what this bill is designed to ask for. And I just think that we should talk about that as the alternative, not the talk about making sure that all these people have track systems and so on. That's for me. Go to any of your local high schools. If they haven't got one now, when they get the student that comes that is in a wheelchair, they will figure out how to make these work in a school system. I think that having them available to people who have actually been trained, because almost every one of our handicapped wheelchair people have this kind of a portable system sometime in their lifetime, whether it was in the schools that they went to or whether it's at their homes that they use. So with that, I just hope that you can figure out how to maybe make this bill work. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Representative, my question is, would you be willing to work with this subgroup?
I would certainly give it as much time as I can possibly do. It's been awfully busy, but I would be glad to add my expertise.
Because I think you have gone on such a track that it looks very, very difficult, and what you're proposing represents.
And I think what the bill says as well.
Just a quick comment, and I appreciate simplicity of how you described it, and that is where we started. And we did bring in some examples and did some research on the internet and had Todd, and the numbers are close. I mean, they're $600 is kind of the minimum. But the problem we had is those particular lifts that you're describing, in some cases, won't fit under the bed. Most of the beds have the boxes under them to get them low enough for the federal ADA stuff. And also because of some, what were they talking about, cleanliness and hygiene stuff, and that's why they have the box under them. So,
and saving workers stress.
The other issue, when you talked about the size of them and where they fit around in a motel room, it's fine to change the size of the doors and the access and whatnot to make it larger if structurally it's available to do that during the remodel. If it affects the structure of the building, they would not be able to accommodate, and that's some of the things we ran into. So I'm in agreement. We did look at the lease cost, and as you can imagine, we had some of the industry folks there, and clearly they were interested in the lease cost. So we didn't just look at track systems.
But again, what I'm saying is that having a room in these hospitals that has a bed that's different than all the others, I think, isn't that big an issue. I mean, there are other ways of doing that. And yes, I understand cleaning underneath all kinds of things is an issue. They cost more. But I would contend if I were in that situation in the hotel, I could come up with solutions to that. I mean, I grew up in a carpenter's family. I would have had a deal that if it wasn't, I have a little wooden deal that fits in around it, and it comes out fairly simply, and it's out as soon as the person that's coming is there, and it only takes a short period of time. A person making an arrangement, you know, you should put on the deal, if you want to use handicap, please give us advance warning. They could have it ready for them, so that there's ways to solve that problem. The issue with regard to the bathrooms, and I understand the structural part, and that one they'd have to look at. But I grew up in a construction family, and I just have a hard time believing that I can't put a little bit more room and put a bearing wall in a slightly different place. Or most of those hotel rooms, I will tell you, there are very little bearing structures in the bathroom walls. They are not bearing walls. The bearing walls are on the outside of that portion, and those are just deals because they always anticipate having to tear that out, do something. If the bathtub gets broken and they want to put a new unit in, they tear out a wall and put it in. So, I mean, I just have a hard time believing that structurally they've put a structural wall in there that's going to make it hard to make a little bit bigger bathroom.
I appreciate that, and I would enjoy having you help us with the work group, because
that would be great. Let's try to set that up as soon as possible.
We don't want to do this here, but there's a lot to it.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. You made reference to a bellhop. And one of the issues, I think, is the assistance. And if the owner has the need for assistance, a 50-room hotel isn't going to, it's going to have to be a lot bigger. And I was trying to think, even down here at the Phoenix, which I don't know how big that is, I don't even know if they have a bellhop. So I'm not sure what size then. 50, I think, is too small based
again,
on...
Again, I'm saying that most of these equipment things, I mean, I do not anticipate seeing a person who's in a wheelchair that needs to use one of these devices not having a person with them. And I would have no problem putting in a bill that says that if you're going to use this, let us know that you're going to have an assistant. I don't think, though, the thing that I'm saying is these machines are very, very similar. It doesn't take a whole lot to figure out between one and the other. But you either have to keep the manual so they can read it if there's anything different, or have the person there. I would say that most hotels that have that bellhop would probably want to have someone that would help instruct, I think would help them. But I would have no problem building in that they have to have the materials necessary to explain how to use the particular device they have, because that's what those people deal with all their lives. And, We've been sitting through hearings on the blind school and other kinds of stuff, and I will tell you, as a high school principal who worked with lots of kids with disabilities, we have an obligation in the schools, and I was appalled to hear that people saying some things they said. When this student shows up, I have every expectation. It is the law that I will figure out a way to accommodate that person in this school building and make them feel a part of that community. And I, along with our school district, took that law very, very seriously. We had a person that came in who was had skin sensitivity, so they couldn't have any ultraviolet light. These lights would give them a sunburn. They showed up. we had to put find these filters that were made in a particular place in I think it was in Washington State, and have them delivered to our school, and every fluorescent light had to be shielded so that person could walk down a hallway. And we had to do that in a very short period of time. And we had multiple buildings. We had to figure out how to get them from one place to another, and also help integrate them into the lives of making other people not think that they were that different, so that they understood that this is a human being and a person that they also wanted to get to know. Those are really difficult things to do. But in schools, we have an obligation to do that. And if we want to continue to make all the citizens feel like they have a place and a part to play in our society, we have to figure out ways that don't make undue burdens, but allow for people to start expanding their ability to have that useful life and that fulfilled life that all of us aspire to. And this is one of those things that I think is a very simple and can be an inexpensive way to do it. It will be doing it differently, and nobody likes to change the patterns of their lives. But I think that once a few people start doing it, others will say, wow, this wouldn't have been that hard. We could have done it. And I do understand the things with beds and all those other kinds of stuff. But we're talking about a room and large hotels, and I just have a hard time not thinking that we can't figure out something to do.
Thank you, Representative. So I think there will be some communication
among
the three of you and setting up some other meetings, and perhaps we can move this bill along. Thank you for coming today, and
thank you
for your passion on this issue. I will close the public hearing on, 2600, and open up the public hearing on House Bill 3388.
This bill expands the definition of a facility for the purposes of residents' Bill of Rights to include residential care facility, a long-term care facility, or an adult foster home, and a residential bill of rights includes the right to receive care from trained staff and to have a diet that meets the resident's special needs.
Okay. Jim Davis and Verna Porter, please.
She walked out.
She walked out on us, huh? Okay. All right.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, representing Parkinson's Resources of Oregon, the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, United Seniors of Oregon, and the Oregon Alliance for Retired Americans. And we're here today to urge the committee to support House Bill 3388, which directs the Department of Human Resources, or Human Services, excuse me, through statute and rule, through the Seniors and People with Disabilities Division, to amend the Patient Bill of Rights in assisted living, residential care facilities, and adult foster homes to provide two things: the right to receive care from staff trained to provide care that is specific to the resident's disease or medical condition, and two, the right to be provided a modified diet that meets the specific requirements of the resident's disease or medical condition. The Adult Foster Home Bill of Rights, as we know it, is in statute, but the others are in administrative rule, so the legislation just appropriately directs and provides instructions for the changes within each Bill of Rights. Last session, our groups supported and passed House Bill 3093, which made the above changes in the Patient Bill of Rights in nursing homes. We had hoped in the 2007 session that we would be able to cover all long-term care facilities, but as it was defined and as it was ultimately put into that legislation, it only dealt with nursing homes and not the community-based long-term care facilities. So we are back in 2009 to complete our work on this issue. House Bill 3388 addresses two critical issues for people with Parkinson's disease, and I think with regard to the staff training really addresses a number of other issues as well, or disease issues such as Alzheimer's and things such as that. We're looking at two areas, in other words, going in and making sure that staff are adequately trained in specific diseases so that they would be able to respond to their residents in appropriate ways. We also want to make note of special diets, which can be very, very important, as you will hear in some of the testimony that will follow. Very, very important for particularly Parkinsonians. Parkinson's Resources had attempted to make recommended changes in the Department of Human Services SPD administrative rules when they dealt with the ALFs and the RCFs, but we only got minimal changes. So our advocates, the Parkinson's advocates, joined with senior advocates, and we decided to take a legislative approach to amend the Bill of Rights, Patient Bill of Rights, for all four areas and incorporate this disease-related language. I did want to express our disappointment that Seniors and People with Disabilities Division would oppose this legislation. We really don't understand totally what the problem is. It is hard to believe that such simple recommendations would have any great effect on their current person-centered approach that they utilize in community-based long-term care facilities, or that it would create more focus on individual diseases or medical conditions. Frankly, we are asking some very simple recommendations. They say, or they will be saying, that providers can be trained through this process to meet individual diseases and medical conditions and dietary needs. That would be through this more person-centered process. Well, so what is the difference? All we're saying is that these individuals should be trained in these things, and through whatever process they want to do, that is fine. Through their initial training, whatever they want to try to, how they want to try to achieve that. We are just asking for basic disease education as a part of required training, and to make some allowances for diet, which they should already be doing with their clients and should is already embedded within the rules. So essentially, we just want community-based facilities and their Bill of Rights to state basic requirements that reach out to those with specific diseases. And so we urge you to support 3388 and the expansion of the Long-Term Care Bill of Rights to include staff training and modified special diets to meet the specific special requirements of medical conditions such as Parkinson's. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. Any questions for Mr. Davis? All right. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Verna and Sarah Scherer and Dr. Lucien Izet Burke. Great. Come on up, please. Go ahead, Verna.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Verna Porter, and I represent the United Seniors of Oregon and the Oregon Alliance for Retired Americans. And I'm going to make this very brief, but I specialized as a geriatric nurse the last many years of my nursing career. And one of the things that's very important to consider, I think, is that diet is so extremely important as we get older to age more healthfully. And unfortunately, as we get older, we forget. And just having a staff that could remind us, I'm diabetic, have been for over 40 years, at one time was insulin dependent, but because of the way I was trained to eat and still remember how to eat, I don't even take medication at this time. And Parkinson's is the main reason we're here, but we need to understand, too, there are some foods that counteract, they act against the medication that some of the patients have to take. So just a simple understanding of dietary needs for a staff, this wouldn't take extensive training, would make a huge difference not only in the health and well-being, but sometimes the very dramatic safety. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Verna. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Committee. My name is Sarah Movia Schur, and I'm the social worker at Parkinson's Resources of Oregon. Parkinson's Resources is a small nonprofit agency, and we provide education and support and advocacy for people with Parkinson's and their families. And every day, I talk to people with Parkinson's and their loved ones about the challenges of living with this chronic progressive illness. Though we don't have an exact count at this time, we think there are about 25,000 people with Parkinson's who live in Oregon and Southwest Washington. The disease generally begins with fairly subtle symptoms like a slight tremor of the hand, but it is a progressive disease, getting worse over time. And so often people who've had this disease for many years require 24-hour care because of difficulty with things like walking or eating and even communicating with other people. In the last session, the legislature passed House Bill 3093, which Parkinson's Resources of Oregon did co-sponsor, and it added two provisions to the Patient's Bill of Rights for nursing home residents, that for a modified diet that's specific to people's medical needs, and one for trained caregivers specific to a patient's medical needs. I have personally heard families talk about how relieved and thankful they are that those provisions are in the Nursing Home Bill of Rights, and I thank you for that. Today we're here asking you to support House Bill 3388, which expands that scope of those important rights to people in assisted living facilities, residential care facilities, and adult foster homes. These facilities are very important in our care community for people with Parkinson's and so many other illnesses. Many people with Parkinson's, when they no longer feel they can live independently, even with in-home care providers coming in a few times a week, will move to an assisted living facility where they can have someone prepare their meals, where they can have medication management, and where someone can be there 24 hours a day in case of a more serious problem like a fall. Adult foster homes are becoming more and more popular as an alternative to nursing homes, where people with even very severe care needs can receive care in a home-like environment with a small team of caregivers who they can develop a very close relationship with. Residents in these facilities really do deserve the same Bill of Rights as people in a nursing home. When we talk about these rights, like the right to an appropriate diet or and caregivers who are trained in these illnesses, this is very important to people with Parkinson's. I want to emphasize, when we talk about appropriate diet, we're not just talking about making the food taste better or be more appealing. We're actually talking about diets that meet people's medical needs, that don't interfere with medication efficacy or don't produce other troublesome side effects. Having trained staff, particularly trained in the particulars of this disease, are so important for people with Parkinson's. For instance, someone with Parkinson's may have very significant fluctuations in their functioning throughout the day. Their ability to walk, their ability to speak, their ability to use cognitive skills well may really fluctuate throughout the day. And if someone is not trained in that aspect of Parkinson's, staff may misinterpret that as resistance or fatigue, when actually it's just part of their medication levels fluctuating. Also, another example, people with Parkinson's often will do what's called freezing, where they'll be walking along and suddenly they're unable to move. Especially this happens like as they enter a doorway or something. There are little tricks to help people be able to take a step and move forward. But if you aren't familiar with Parkinson's and some of these little things, a staff person might not know how to help someone move forward and might, again, misunderstand those symptoms. All too often, the training for this sort of thing falls to the burden of the patient themselves or their family caregivers, and when the patient and the family need to be training the staff, that can produce a very uncomfortable dynamic between the care team and the patients. So there are a number of opportunities for staff people to receive training. Yes, Parkinson's Resources of Oregon does offer on-site training, but there are also textbooks, there are other agencies that offer training, there are videos, there are online trainings, there are a number of very reputable places for assisted living and residential care and foster home staff to get training in Parkinson's disease and other diseases that they are working with in their job. I thank you very much for your time and for your consideration of House Bill 3388. Adding diet and training from the Nursing Home Bill of Rights was a really good thing to do. And please expand those rights to people who are living in residential care, assisted living, and adult foster homes. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Go ahead. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for permitting me to speak on behalf of thousands of Parkinsonians on House Bill 3388. I am Dr. Lucian Burke, a medically retired diagnostic radiologist, and I'm a board member of Parkinson's Resources of Oregon. Dopamine is a critical neurochemical. It's a neurotransmitter that is progressively lacking in patients with Parkinson's disease. Neurotransmitters are complex chemicals that take impulses from the motor cortex of the brain to the extremities and allow function to be normal. That function is missing or altered in people with Parkinson's disease. Levodopa is the most common and most effective replacement drug in this disease, and it's been available for decades. I would like briefly to discuss the relationship of oral replacement dopamine and protein in the diet of individuals with Parkinson's. The binding or carrier sites which dopamine uses to reach and cross the blood-brain barrier are competed for by protein in the diet. When protein and dopamine are given together, the net effect of the medication is substantially reduced. This bill does not attempt to control the timing of medications, but it does emphasize that dietary protein should be minimized, avoided, or delayed if this medication has just been given. It's as simple as that. In summary, individuals with Parkinson's whose dietary protein is timed have less falls and function much better throughout the day. House Bill 3388 speaks to the importance of diet in this disease, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions that you might ask.
Thank you very much, Dr. Burke. Any questions of anyone on this panel? Thank you so much for coming today
Thank
and sharing
you.
Your
Thank
information
you.
With us.
So we have Garwin Reiser, is it? Elaine Kaus? And okay.
Hi there. Madam Chairman and committee members, I'm Elaine Callis, and I serve on the board of directors of PRO, Parkinson's Resources of Oregon. Because of a variety of illnesses in my family, I counted up last night and I realized I've been advocating or caregiving for 40 years. So I feel like I have a little experience. While considering HB 3388, I'd like you to imagine one of your loved ones, taking one of your loved ones to a care facility, and you step into the room and you see panic on their face because they have just frozen in place. That's what can happen, as Dr. Burke explained. That's what can happen to a Parkinsonian if some of the considerations of their disease aren't taken seriously and if the caregiver is not aware of them. This bill would bring us a step closer to providing assurance for family members so they could be more confident in entrusting the professionals to adequately care for their loved ones. While the bill offers rights to the patient, it also helps the caregiving team be more efficient, confident, and effective in their care, not to mention their ability to avoid costly incidents, in particular falls. It would be very frustrating from a caregiver's standpoint, I feel. They're responsible for providing quality care, but if they lack the basic knowledge of the disease and the patient's needs, it puts them at a disadvantage. I am aware that apparently some people are opposed to this bill. I, frankly, as a layperson and a past caregiver, I cannot imagine why. While it might require a certain amount of additional training, to me it's minimal training for the payoff, and considering needs of a patient to me is absolutely fundamental in a caregiving setting. And after all, these patients are paying dearly for this care. This bill provides a very minimum standard. It's not a huge commitment, and I feel the facilities, and I feel they should expect and desire, as much as we do as patient advocates, to provide at least the minimum care. Thank you for your consideration of House Bill 3388.
Thank you for coming to testify today.
I'm Madam Chairman and committee. I'm Garvin Reiter. I'm an attorney. I specialize in elder law. And I want to give you maybe a legal perspective on why we feel this, that this bill is appropriate. Right now, when somebody enters into an assisted living facility or community-based care, probably the legal source of their rights to care are defined in something called a care plan. You have a care conference with typically the resident and the family upon entry into the facility, and you talk about the specifics of your disease and the type of care that you're going to get. To the extent there's going to be any legal enforcement of your rights in the facility, it's going to come out of that meeting. And really, I think the intent of the bill is to assist the resident in that effort, because right now the onus is on the resident to advocate for himself or herself. That's something that our organization, Parkinson's Resources of Oregon, does. We help people put together care plans. We've put together user-friendly documents that they work together with their physicians so that they can go into those meetings and advocate for themselves. But if we have an extension of the existing law to the community-based care arena so that the facility is on notice, that this is actually a right of the resident, I think it helps make sure that those care plans are adequate, because it underscores that this is one of their rights. There is an enforcement element to the bill. I think that SPD has, or Department of Human Services has, I don't know that they've really developed a sense of, you know, what the nursing home statute means in terms of enforcement, but that's something that our organization is working on too. I mean, we're trying to partner with DHS to make them aware that violations of the Nursing Home Bill of Rights, and if this bill passes, the Community-Based Care Bill of Rights, are then enforceable by DHS, and that's something that's really lacking now. Because a violation of the Bill of Rights would be considered something that fall in their purview. So that's another area that we think is important. And finally, I think DHS and the Oregon Healthcare Association are essentially going to argue that by passing this bill, this sort of puts a nursing home level of requirements on community-based care facilities, and, you know, they're distinct. Nursing homes are nursing homes and deal with medical. Assistive living facilities are sort of non-medical. This is not a medical issue. What we're really asking for is to have assisted living facilities, community-based care organizations do what family members do. Family members, who are most of the care providers for people with Parkinson's and other ailments, they're trained in the issue of how diet affects medication. They're trained in some of the things that were brought to your attention, like freezing and other things that happen. And that's really all we're asking for, is to get adequate layperson standards in place for these facilities. The facilities advertise and explain to their prospective clients that they offer this level of care. It's part of their business model. So if they're going to do that, we just feel that it's appropriate that they actually have the training and knowledge to provide that care. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of anyone on this panel? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where would they get the training? Who does the training?
Thank you very much for asking. That's another thing that we do as an organization. We have developed a fairly comprehensive training program, and we offer it now to nursing homes and assisted living facilities. And quite frankly, we're not having the level of response that we would like, but it's a very low-cost and very high-quality training program, and that is definitely part of what we're trying to do as an organization, is to offer this. We had a meeting with James Taves the other day in which we basically said, look, we want to partner with DHS and work out ways to get our training protocol out there. We want to explore things like having a Parkinson's Center of Excellence, some sort of, you know, those types of programs with DHS. So we're absolutely available as a resource to provide the training, and it's extremely low cost. So we are a resource there. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Thank
you.
Madam Chair.
Oh, sorry, didn't see you.
Thank you. So what was James's response?
He thought it was a good idea, and but we're just sort of beginning a partnership, I guess we could say at this point. I think that they are interested in finding low-cost, budget-neutral ways to improve quality care. And I think that this falls into that category. We're not asking for any government expenditures here, and we see it as a way to elevate the standard of care. So I think that they are receptive to working with us, but I can't say that, you know, we've really begun earnest negotiations, but maybe with the prodding of this committee, we could move along in that direction.
Follow up. And I've just got the summary, but it doesn't specify Parkinson's.
No, it doesn't.
3388. So there are probably many other advocate groups out there that would advocate for their particular disease or disability also. Is that correct?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. Now, for Parkinson's, diet couldn't be more important. And that's why that's the focus of our bill. But that certainly would apply to other diseases as well. I think training, obviously, is going to cut across many different diseases and is a critical issue for everybody.
One last follow-up. Have you found that there is a problem? I mean, some of the foster family homes are 3 to 5 people. They're quite small. Have you found a pushback from the group that's being addressed in 3388? Why are we doing this, I guess?
Well, the quality of care, particularly in community-based care facilities, there's a training issue. I mean, there's definitely what our people have seen and report to us is that the staff does not really know anything about Parkinson's disease. And it's such an issue for us because with just some basic training, the quality of care can be so much higher, and there are so many issues about, the best example is the timing of medication. Like Dr. Burke was saying, you eat at a certain time, you have to take your meds at a certain time, and if you get it right, there's a higher quality of care. If you get it wrong, there isn't. And we don't see that. I mean, I think across the board, there is extremely little recognition by care providers of those basic concepts, and we feel that that could be addressed with our training protocol.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Van Norman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. One of the experiences that I've had running a nonprofit poverty program with low pay is that when you have low pay, you end up with a shallow pool, and then you have high turnover.
Mm-hmm.
And is that part of the problem, the turnover and the ability to train?
I think you're exactly right, Representative Van Oren. It's it is difficult to, this is something we've grappled with the idea of having maybe a Parkinson's Center of Excellence. Because there's so much turnover, how would you know that the people you train on Monday are going to be there on Tuesday? That's true. However, I don't think that takes away from the obligation of the facility to see that their new staff receive just basic training for when they've got a resident with PD in their facility, they're going to have to, to the extent that their new people are providing care to that person with Parkinson's, that person needs to be trained. So, yeah.
Follow-up. So is it possible then if you have some key staff on a site that were trained, that they then could train their peers?
Yes, and that's what our training protocol mostly does. I mean, we offer the training to anybody we can get into the room, but we certainly focus on training the trainers.
Thank you.
So, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Any further questions? Thank you both very much for coming.
Thank you.
Now we'll have Lauren Rhodes, Ruth Gaius, and Mary Gear.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Gear. I'm the administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care in the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities Division. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about these very important issues. I'm in the very unenviable position of coming before you to oppose this bill as written.
And I'd like to be real clear that opposition to this bill as written does not in any way oppose any of the goals around training, enforcement, regulatory expectations that have been mentioned so far. There are some concerns that we as a department have about this bill that I'll go into, and that is clearly spelled out in my testimony. One thing I simply want to mention is that the bill as written applies these resident rights to all adult foster homes and all residential care facilities. So under current statute and rule, that would include assisted living, residential care facilities, and adult foster homes that serve people with physical disabilities and seniors. It would also include those residential settings that serve people with developmental disabilities and people with addictions and mental health issues. The department was very pleased to work with Parkinson's Resources of Oregon in the 07 session to add to the Nursing Facility Bill of Rights. And we were very comfortable doing that because in a nursing facility setting, there is a requirement for skilled nursing and there is a set curriculum for training for the caregivers in that situation. And so implementation and regulation, the follow-up regulation of those particular Bill of Rights was easily accommodated in that setting. House Bill 3388 seeks to expand those resident rights to our community-based care settings. And the concern, one of the major concerns that we have around that is it really fails to acknowledge that community-based care settings are significantly different and staffed differently than nursing facility settings. In a residential care setting, for example, that might have, say, 60 people, the staffing would be that the direct caregivers would need to be trained to provide the care needs that are identified in a service plan, as mentioned before, for those particular residents. And that may mean that medication has to be given at a certain time or that diet needs to consist of particular items or exclude certain items or also be given at a particular time. There is a requirement that nursing services be available, but not on a 24-hour basis and maybe not even on a daily basis, depending on the needs of the residents in that home. So the focus of the caregiver training is very much on what are the service needs of the people in that building and how can those needs best be met. One of the concerns from a regulatory perspective that I would have is in a building, say, of 60 individuals, the scope of medical conditions that would be encompassed in that building is potentially huge. As Representative Huffman asked it, the last person who testified, that the medical conditions in that building may be everything from traumatic brain injury to a developmental disability to high blood pressure to a stroke to a spinal cord injury to Parkinson's to any number of medical conditions. And so as read, what would be required then is in community-based care, when we go in to look at staff training, we would need to assure that every caregiver who took care of a specific individual was trained in the diagnosis specific to that individual. And there is a bit of concern on my part about the workload and whether that's really the primary focus or one of the key areas that we as a regulatory agency ought to be spending our time. Because of the very strong focus on person-centered care in community-based settings, there are current regulatory requirements that the service needs and medical needs of individuals be met. And so it's very important that when individuals' care needs are not met, that individual or their representatives contact the department so that we can intervene, use our regulatory process to ensure that there is adequate training and that the person's medical needs indeed are met. As mentioned, my boss, James Taves, met with the Parkinson's Resources of Oregon last week at their invitation, and we began what I hope to be a very fruitful discussion about how to ensure that the needs of folks with Parkinson's disease are met in our community-based care setting.
we see that there are a number of ways that that could happen, including a model that we already use for our memory care, our Alzheimer's units. We have a special endorsement with particular training requirements and physical plant requirements and an increased Medicaid reimbursement rate for those units. So we've recognized the unique needs of people with Alzheimer's. We've worked with the Alzheimer's Association and come up with a set of rules that specifically address those care needs. A model with that, I think could work very well for some kind of endorsement or Parkinson's seal of excellence or whatever it may be called in those kinds of settings. So I also want to just briefly address the issue of the residential care and assisted living rules. That rule process ended a little bit over 3 years ago, or almost 3 years ago under my predecessor. And since implementation of those rules, there have been a number of areas that we've identified that really need to be looked at again. And so it is fully our intention to open those rules one more time and invite to the table all of those who have concerns about what was left out of the rule or what might need to be clarified. And so most certainly the Parkinson's Resource Organization would be invited to join us at the table for some further discussion about how we can ensure that these needs might be met. So again, we do have some concerns about this bill as written. We'd be very happy to work with not only the Parkinson's Association but other organizations to ensure that some disease-specific or condition-specific needs might be met in different situations. It's simply our belief that this is not the best vehicle in order to ensure that those needs get met. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Quick questions? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mary, I don't see in the bill where it says every staff member needs to be trained in every medical condition of the residents.
Representative Tovey and Representative Boone, thank you for the clarifying question. And I'm not meaning to suggest that the bill does say that. What we would do is we would look at it, an individual, say, and what their care conditions were and assure that the caregivers who provided services to that individual had the training, which is what the bill requires as I read it.
Okay, we're going to continue on. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ruth Gulliason. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services, representing not-for-profit mission directors, providers of quality services and housing, including nursing homes, assisted living, and residential care. And back in 2007, we didn't oppose applying this to nursing homes. We do have some issues, though, with applying it and extending it to assisted living and residential care. And that is because there are some real significant differences between those levels of care, both what Mary Geer spoke to in terms of the level of staffing, particularly around nursing services, the training required of caregivers, as well as the variety of conditions, the service profile of residents being served within those settings, as well as the level of Medicaid reimbursement. Current assisted living rules do require that assisted living and residential care providers provide modified special diets to meet the needs of their residents. And assisted living and residential care are required to meet their needs of their residents within their overall service capability that they must disclose to a resident prior to moving in. They do not have to, though, deal with the very specific related requirements of a variety of diseases, and that's what the bill speaks to. And we would not feel comfortable, and nor would our providers be prepared to deal with the whole host of unlimited diseases within that community-based setting. Additionally, providers within the same licensing category in assisted living and residential care, they can vary tremendously in the medical conditions they can accommodate. For example, there are some adult foster cares that are specializing in traumatic brain injury and are doing that quite well. Now, if I had an assisted living provider, one of my assisted living providers out in rural Oregon, resident, got in a car accident and received traumatic brain injury, under this, they would be required to provide the training to the staff to a level of care that they're not ready to provide to that resident, and that's a concern as well.
Also, I have to speak to the level of reimbursement. There's, and we are very grateful to the legislature for the bump that we saw in community-based care Medicaid rates to try to bring access back to residents through that enhanced rate. This would be additional requirements up on a level of care which receives a much lower reimbursement level than nursing facilities do. Finally, our organization provides training regularly and have provided training in the past on Parkinson's disease and invited training to our conferences and make that available on a widespread basis. And we would very much welcome working with the proponents of the bill to do that in the future. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We're going to move on, and then we'll see if there are questions.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, for the record, Lauren Rhodes representing the Oregon Healthcare Association, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to explain better about our position and where we stand on this bill. In 2007, when a similar bill was brought before the legislature and applied to nursing facilities, we worked with Parkinson's Resources of Oregon and their representatives to come to a compromise that we felt we could live with in the nursing facility settings. This bill is a little bit different because of, as has been said at this table, the application to community-based care settings. And I would just bring to your attention, I know it's confusing, all these rules and references and residents' rights and all these various terms that have been thrown out today, but as I believe Mary Geer made clear, that current Oregon administrative rules do require that community-based care facilities make available. I'll go in the order. It requires all direct caregivers to complete annual in-service trainings, and including training on chronic diseases in the facility population that they serve. Additionally, facilities are required to provide, through rule, modified special diets that are appropriate to residents' needs and choices. So what I want to try and just make sure is clear here is that what the goal of the bill is to do is to make this a secondary requirement in the Residents' Bill of Rights, but it is already under the facility regulatory structure. If facilities aren't providing that level of care or not meeting those needs, by all means, SPD and the department has the enforcement authority to cite them, to cite violations. I know we've talked a lot about the session violations and penalties, and this is precisely what those are for, is to make sure the providers are meeting the requirements that exist in statute and in rule. The department regularly does that, as you've heard me say, partly some of my concerns. And again, this is somewhat of a duplicative burden, if you will, in that if a violation occurs because, let's say, a facility hadn't trained on a chronic disease or hadn't met a modified diet, as is required in rule, they then could have a secondary violation for that very same incident because they failed to comply with that resident right. So what this really does is add somewhat of a punitive nature to the violation. Sadly, I really respect and understand where the group is coming from. I'm just not sure that a legislative solution gets at what they want, which is general understanding and awareness and better attention to the specific needs of the individuals. That said, after the 2007 session, the Oregon Healthcare Association reached out to Parkinson's Resources of Oregon. We attempted to engage them and in a very serious way to encourage our members to accept and implement their education materials. We have had representatives of the Parkinson's Resources of Oregon speak at our conferences, at various education sessions. We'd be more than happy to make all of their training programs available to our members. I know that we've worked really collaboratively with them, and I'm sorry that there's confusion about how widespread the education is. I think it's extremely important to get this information out there. They've done an excellent job of developing tremendously detailed and helpful resources. It's in our true best interest to make sure that these are available to all of our members to enhance the care that's delivered, and we would like to continue to do that on a regular basis. I just think, unfortunately, this specific legislation doesn't necessarily achieve a solution to the problem that that they're searching for, and I'd like to continue to work with them in ways that we can enhance the overall understanding of the seriousness of this disease, but at this point in time feel that this application to the community-based care setting doesn't achieve the goal that, that they're searching for. So I'd be happy to answer any questions and
Thank you, Lauren. Mary, I'm going to ask a question of you. So it seems that the Bill of Rights that this bill is referencing does already apply to certain facilities, and what this group is trying to do is to apply it to different facilities. So can you tell us briefly what facilities, what long-term care facilities this Bill of Rights that's referenced and ORS 441.612.
Certainly, Chair Tomei. The current statute applies these particular rights to residents in nursing facilities. So that's a person with any condition who resides in a nursing facility. The House
and
bill...
And a nursing facility, can give us a brief definition of a nursing facility.
A nursing facility is a facility that's licensed to provide 24-hour skilled nursing care. So there are requirements for RN services, a certain number of hours a day, trained caregivers under a federally mandated curriculum, those kinds of things. House Bill 3388 seeks to expand those rights to assisted living facilities and residential care facilities.
And explain those briefly.
Mm-hmm. Those are care facilities that hold that particular license, and they serve as an alternative to a nursing facility for people who don't need 24-hour skilled nursing care. So there is some nursing available. Primarily, folks in those settings need personal care services, assistance with activities of daily living like bathing, like dressing, may need some help getting around, may need some cueing to remember to eat or those kinds of things. It also expands it to adult foster homes, and those are settings of five people or less in an individual's home, typically, where the licensee, the individual is the caregiver, may have other staff that they hire, but it's typically not very many, and often it's not around the clock caregiving, although as Ruth mentioned, in some of our specialty settings, like our foster homes that specifically provide care for traumatic brain injury, we do have what looks a little bit more like shift care. And these are more intimate settings where folks can establish relationships with their caregivers. As I mentioned, the bill as written also expands these rights to those residential settings and adult foster homes that serve people with developmental disabilities. And those tend to be group home settings of five people or less, or adult foster home settings. It also includes the residential settings and the adult foster homes that include people with addictions and mental health issues. So those may be, again, foster homes are five people or less, maybe five people who have gone through some treatment, who are looking to become more independent, and really foster homes, my understanding, in the mental health system are used as a stepping stone to independent living. And then more residential treatment settings for addictions and mental health are focused on treatment.
If I can stop you there for a second, Mary, a long-term care facility is defined in ORS 442.015. So what would that, explain that briefly to us?
442.015 defines a long-term care facility as a nursing facility. So this bill is written, pardon me while I pull the actual bill language out, thank you. This bill is written, includes, 442.015 is the C, and that is a nursing facility as written. Right. The adult foster home right above that is adult foster homes for all three of our systems, DD, mental health, and the senior system. And then residential care facility includes the residential training centers, the residential treatment centers. Those are DD and mental health, as well as assisted living and residential care for seniors.
Great. Thank you so much. A representative of Boone. Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What about a facility like Florida Plaza that has multiple levels of care from assisted living, independent living, assisted living, and then acute care, and then whatever the most highest level of care? How would that be here?
Chair Tomei and Representative Boone, I don't know offhand if Terwilliger is a CCRC. Is it independent?
Chair Tomei and Representative Boone, Terwilliger Plaza is a registered continuing care retirement community. They are also licensed to provide residential care. So the residential care component would fall under this.
But not the, excuse me, but not the assisted living or...
They have assisted living and residential care. They do not have a nursing...
Yes, they do.
I'm sorry. I'm mistaken.
But I just wondered if the facility's covered or just parts of it, or how does that work?
The specific requirements in this would be the license component. It would be the residential care within them. It wouldn't cover their independent. It would cover the license components.
Representative Dembro, and then we're going to move on because we have another bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lauren, thanks for the presentation on you know, in a very detailed way of what the facilities are doing and are required to do. And I'm wondering, the documentation that the OAR requires them to do, is that just stored or is it reported on a regular basis, you know, to SPD or... I have a few related questions.
Chair Tomei, Representative Dembro, you're referring to the documentation that caregivers complete their training requirements. Is that the documentation you're referencing?
Yes, that's right.
I'm gonna let Mary answer that because I don't know where the documentation actually is reported to.
Chair Tomei and Representative Dembro, documentation about staff training is stored at the facility. And so in our regulatory process, when we go in to assure that staff have been trained, we'll pull the training records and make sure that the caregivers have had the required amount of hours of training in the year and those kinds of things.
Right. And so would... Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And so when the training is on the chronic diseases in the facility population, so if the facility did have, over the course of a year, a Parkinson's patient entered the facility, then the training for the subsequent year would change so that it would include a Parkinson-focused kind of curriculum?
Chair Tomei, Representative Dembro, that's my understanding, yes. And those trainings are available in a variety of sources. In fact, I made a note here with the bill that you just passed out of committee, House Bill 2442, and the training opportunities that are in that new quality care fund that's established in that bill.
Right.
For instance, that could be an opportunity where the department could develop some disease-specific trainings or whatever it might be that's currently out there in terms of the populations that are served in facilities. And facilities do keep detailed records and information on the specific care needs of the individuals residing in the facility. So that information is not only available to the facility, but also would be available to the department upon review as well.
Right. The department would probably only know about it, though, if there were a complaint. Is that right? I mean, or is this something that would show up on a kind of regular monitoring visit?
Chair Tomei and Representative Dembro, I have to apologize. I'm not sure I followed your question.
To make sure that it is disease-specific training that's happening and that it's updated based on who the residents are. That's something that your office would only know about if somebody complained about it. Is that right?
Chair Tomei and Representative Dembro, actually when we do our licensing inspections, which is every 2 years in residential care every year in a foster home, we look at what the curriculum has been, what curriculum has been offered to ensure that it's relevant.
Mm-hmm. And look to see, and relevant meaning that it matches up with the population.
Absolutely.
Okay,
yes.
Thanks. And then one other question. This applies to facilities, but not to adult foster care. Is that right? And there, what that would just be complaint-driven.
Chair Tomei and Representative Dembrow, the bill as written does apply to adult foster homes, and we not only investigate complaints in foster homes, but we do annual licensing visits. And foster homes do have a continuing education requirement of 12 hours a year. I believe it's 10 hours in the mental health and DD systems. And the department very actively develops curricula for foster home providers that we provide at very low cost so that they can meet those continuing education requirements as well as, you know, whatever training may be offered in their community.
Okay. Thank you very much. And we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3388 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3392. So Jim Davis, Verna Porter, and then the other two will be later.
We have Garvin Ryder.
Sure.
Thank you.
Colleagues, can we go over a few minutes if there's a little extra testimony? I hate to have people. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, representing Parkinson's Resources of Oregon, the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, United Seniors of Oregon, and the Oregon Alliance for Retired Americans. We're here today in strong support of House Bill 3392, which deals with spousal impoverishment, and we appreciate the fact that you gave us a hearing on this bill. I'm just going to do a brief overview, and Verna can as well, and then we're going to hand it over to Garvin for more detail on this bill. Spousal impoverishment has been a very important issue to us, especially around protections within federal and state Medicaid law that protects spouses of individuals applying for Medicaid by providing them with reasonable income and resources that they might need to remain at home and independent and have a financial base there. One of the most important resources that is available to our community spouses is the right to go to a court of law and have an independent assessment of the spouse's support needs and award income and resources. In 2006, DHS implemented what they call an income first rule and applied it to these court orders of support, and it effectively, essentially eliminated the ability of the spouse to seek an independent court review support request. And what essentially we're doing with this bill is we're turning back the clock to 2006, before this rule was implemented. Now, the DHS has said this rule applies to the Federal Deficit Reduction Act, but Oregon seems to be the only state interpreting it in the way that they are. And so they acted without legislative input, and we think that it was not appropriate, and we want to reverse this and take it back to 2006 with a system that we felt worked effectively. So we ask for your support of this legislation, and ultimately we'd like Garvin to fill you in with a little more detail. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Chairwoman, members of the committee, again, I'm Verna Porter, and I represent the Oregon Alliance for Retired Americans and United Seniors of Oregon. And again, I'm talking from my experience as a retired nurse who my last many years of my service work. I specialized in geriatric nursing. And I was telling earlier about some of the impoverishment I had seen. One woman in particular did not, you know, we all feel we're not getting older. You know, I'm okay, we're okay. The assets this couple had were not, you know, they weren't wealthy, but they were certainly very comfortable in the Milwaukee Gladstone area with a very lovely home, savings, etc. And he became ill with a long, drawn-out terminal illness. And by time he died, she was still a relatively young-feeling, healthy woman. She had no home. It was one of her assets. All the savings were gone, and gratefully, she had children. She went to live with one of them, and they were astounded at how it took everything they thought she would have to live on from them to care for him until he died. That's only one of many stories. I have also seen people, because they feared this type of result, to sell everything liquidated and buy into community housing where it would not go away. And I just feel very strongly that we need to do something to protect that spouse, whether male or female. My family has done things to protect me. I no longer own and live in my own home, but not everyone has that opportunity or privilege. So thank you.
Thank you, Verna.
Madam Chair and committee members, again, I'm Garvin Ryder. I'm an attorney, and so people come to see me when, oftentimes, when their spouse needs to apply for Medicaid assistance. The way it works in this state and in other states is that Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities, SPD, is authorized and has a sort of a formula approach to say this is what the adequate and reasonable support needs of the spouse are. And so there's a formula. And the formula doesn't take into consideration the actual circumstances of people with spouses with individual needs. A good example of that would be that you might have a spouse who's a lot younger than the impaired spouse. You might have a spouse who will lose all of the income, the retirement income of the impaired spouse upon that individual's death. There's a lot of reasons why the spouse might need a higher level of support than the minimal amount set out in the formula that SPD puts forth. When the spousal impoverishment rules were created by federal law in 1989, it was designed so that there would be an alternative to having the state agencies be the only body who would determine support needs. So there's one track, which is through the agency, the formula approach. But the law, as written in 89 and as it exists today, gives you the right to ask a judge to take a second look. And it's very clear that the courts do have a sort of supervening role over the agency because Congress said that it wasn't fair to have just that formula and have the state agencies be the only arbiter of that decision. So you do have the right under federal law to ask a judge to weigh your personal circumstances. In 2006, the federal government passed a law called the Deficit Reduction Act. Oregon has been the only state, to our knowledge, that has said that this act changed in some way the right to go to court to seek an individual assessment of your support needs. It did not do that. There is nothing in the Federal Deficit Reduction Act that in any way changed the right to go to court. And what they have done is taken a rule called the Income First Rule that applies to agency proceedings and imposed that onto this court order of support. It's very technical, but the bottom line is that very few individuals, by virtue of this Income First Rule, can now ask a court to award support. It is essentially only couples where both the husband and the wife have very low income where you could even ask a court for support. And that has really taken away the ability to seek this type of relief, because as a threshold, just to get in the door, you're going to have to show that you are one of those people for whom you've got two people with extremely low income. It doesn't matter what happens. So, for example, if the husband has higher income, under the Income First Rule, you don't even have the opportunity to ask a court when that income will go away on the husband's death, for example. So what ends up happening is resources are required to be spent before you can qualify for Medicaid. So those resources are gone. There is, and then if the husband does pass away and his income is also gone, now the spouse, upon his death, and it is typically the wife we're talking about, is going to have those, the resources are gone, the income is gone. That is the classic example of why you would go to court and have that ability to say to a judge, in this situation, I should be allowed to keep some of those resources because of these circumstances. That is not captured in the formula approach, and it is not, and it is now, by virtue of the income first rule, not possible to ask a court to even take that into consideration. So our position is that, first of all, the rule is just not supportable by federal law. And it will be heard in the courts unless we come up with a legislative solution, because, like I said, this is the only state that has applied this income first rule to the area of court orders of support. That law has been consistent since 1989. For 17 years, between 1989 and 2006, this is what we had in the state of Oregon. It did not put an undue strain on the budget. It wasn't a situation where there were, you know, thousands of people who were coming to court and sort of taking advantage of the system. It is not a means of getting excessive awards of assets, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and a way to support sort of an opulent lifestyle, which is what DHS is going to tell you. It is a way of, the legal standard that exists is that the courts are required to authorize a reasonable but not excessive amount of support. All that this bill would do is supersede the administrative rule that has effectively taken away the ability to ask for court relief. It does not insert any particular standard. It does not tell the courts this is what you're going to do when you hear these cases. It just takes away this bar that was put on the process, in our view, illegally. So the courts would be in a position that they were in for the last, you know, for 16 years before this change came about in 2006, where they did what they're supposed to do, take a view of the circumstances and figure out what they think is a reasonable basis of support. When the system was in place during that 17 years, you did not see a lot of excessive awards. And the reason is that SPD would object. So if you were going to go into court and ask for $500,000 and a large house, they were going to say, we're not going to go for that, and that would not happen. And it was a very effective system that worked well during that 17-year period. It did not lead to, you know, some sort of opulent lifestyle on the part of the community spouse. But it did take into consideration the factors that are now off the table, effectively, when you're dealing with these spousal impoverishment rules. Last thing I want to say is, this is just one of the spousal impoverishment protections that SPD has taken upon itself to change over the last, I don't know, probably 5 years, but especially since Deficit Reduction Act came about. Without any input from elected officials, they have done, for example, they've expanded estate recovery to be able to assert claims against spouses who never go on to Medicaid by rule. They have taken upon themselves to change the rules with respect to annuities, with respect to promissory notes. There are a host of different rule changes that have come about in the last few years that are all designed to take away the ability of spouses to receive adequate support to live on. They basically want this formula to apply in every case. And this is the most important tool. The number one thing that would be available to spouses, without question, is the ability to seek an independent court order. SPD doesn't even really believe that the courts have any legal authority or role in telling them how to administer their program. I mean, I had a discussion with them yesterday, and they're sort of offended at the concept that a court would even be able to tell them what to do with their program. That is what federal law requires, and it's very clear that nothing has changed in federal law. So, you know, we're just trying to reopen the right that we had for the past 17 years and put us back to where we were. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Anyone on this panel? All right. Thank you very much for coming today. We also will hear Deanna Hartwig and Sarah. Sarah, I think we'll hear you first.
Okay. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Committee. Well, you already know who I am and you already know what I do. And I want to talk to you a little bit about why I believe, as the social worker at Parkinson's Resources, that...
State your name again.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm Sarah Movia Schur. I'm the social worker at Parkinson's Resources of Oregon.
Thank you.
I'd like to speak with you a little bit about why I believe that House Bill 3392 would be a benefit to the families I work with, as they're dealing with the increased care needs and increasing care needs of their loved ones with Parkinson's disease. As in part of my role, my social work role in the agency, I deal with many people who are stressed and exhausted from providing day and night care for a spouse with Parkinson's disease, often to the detriment of their own health. When I suggest that their loved one may be at a stage where they need professional care, I often hear their fear about the cost involved, and with good reason. It's very expensive to provide that kind of care. So I often bring up the possibility of Medicaid down the road, and the first thing I hear from them is a fear of their own impoverishment. And they fear so much for their own financial stability. Two examples I want to give. One young woman whose husband has young-onset Parkinson's disease and is continuing to try to support their children has been advised by so many of her friends to divorce him quickly while she can so that she can maintain enough assets to take care of their family. And she loves her husband. She does not want to divorce him in any way. I'm also thinking about an older caregiver who is providing day and night care for his wife. When I bring up Medicaid as a possibility, he has a great fear that because he is in good health himself and expects to live many years past his wife's passing, that he'll be left destitute. And my concern is that this fear of impoverishment keeps people from reaching out and getting the help they need to avoid their own exhaustion and illness. So, please consider helping these people to feel like they have their day in court available so that they are willing to reach out and ask for help. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Sir, I'm not sure who you are.
My name is Dale Morandi. I'm a manager for senior people with disabilities.
Great. Thank you. So I'll let you two choose who will speak first. Okay.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. I'm Deanna Hartwig, the Administrator of the Office of Federal Resource and Financial Eligibility, Seniors and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services. The department opposes House Bill 3392 for the following reasons. It will allow individuals with substantial resources to become eligible for Medicaid by completely bypassing the income first requirement or exhausting current administrative remedies. It conflicts with federal statute that allows courts to use income first. This bill would prohibit courts from using the income first methodology. It puts the courts in the position of making a financial determination for Medicaid eligibility, which conflicts with Medicaid regulations. And it will have a significant fiscal impact that is not anticipated in the governor's recommended budget. As you heard prior, federal law does dictate how resources and income are divided between spouses when one of them needs long-term care Medicaid services. In these cases, the community spouse is the one who does not need long-term care, and we use the term institutional spouse for the person who is requesting services. Federal statutes do allow court orders prior to the Deficit Reduction Act. It states could use the income first, which means you would look at the income of the spouse needing services, or you could look at joint resources. When the Deficit Reduction Act passed in 2005, it mandated the use of the income first methodology, and it was enacted by Congress to limit people with large resources from receiving Medicaid without utilizing the income available to them. However, recognizing that some unique circumstances do exist, the department does have an administrative rule that takes into account undue hardship on the community spouse. And we, in fact, today will utilize the joint resources of the couple for the community spouse if the income for the individual requesting services is insufficient to meet the monthly needs of the community spouse. This bill allows a community spouse to file in circuit court for an order of support prior to exhausting the administrative remedies in place today and prohibits the court from using the income first calculation. This will allow individuals to become eligible for Medicaid sooner because they are not utilizing all of the resources available to them. What we see today is community spouses will petition the court when they don't consider the Medicaid calculation or allocation adequate for their specific living circumstances and needs. The objection we have, as I've said a couple of times, is this bill would not allow the courts to even consider the income first methodology, even if it would adequately address the needs of the community spouse. The other primary concern we have with this particular bill is that federal regulations specify that Medicaid eligibility decisions must be made by the state Medicaid agency. So if you allow the determination of community spouses' income allowance and resource allowances to be made by a court, that shifts a responsibility that's primarily performed by seniors and people with disabilities in the Department of Human Services. So for those reasons, we are opposing this bill. A couple things I might point out. When we start looking at the income need of the community spouse, the one who's not requesting long-term care services, we usually use $1,750 a month as a starting point for their monthly income needs. At the local level, our case managers can work with the couple and anyone representing them to move up to even $2,700 a month in support for the community spouse. If the spouse wants more than that, that request usually comes up to my office where a policy analyst will review what they're asking for and determine whether we would accept that or not. In terms of resources that are available to community spouses, typically the starting point for that is $100,000. So if the couple has resources of approximately $200,000, the community spouse would get to keep $100,000, and we would determine $100,000 would be available to care for the cost or pay for the care costs of the person needing long-term care services. So that's kind of where we start. I think what you've heard is there's probably a different interpretation of what is considered reasonable support for a community spouse to prevent impoverishment and what might be necessary to maintain a certain lifestyle. If you have particular questions about how we look at these petitions as they come to the office, Del Mirande can talk in more detail about the calculation methodology that we follow that's prescribed by the federal government and how we apply that in these circumstances.
Thank you, Deanna. I have some questions. So what we heard from an earlier testifier was that Oregon is the only state in the union that determines this income this way?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, we did hear that yesterday. We are going to be contacting other states to find out how they interpreted that particular provision of the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. We did use that as the basis for doing our administrative rule change. We publicized that rule change. We did get public hearing on that particular rule, and we have been implementing the income first requirement since that time. It is true, prior to, I think it was 2006 when we actually put the bill or the rule into effect, we would look at income and resources and make a joint determination as to how much could be used for the community spouse. So we will follow up on that issue.
Great, thank you. So we heard about an example of a young woman who had apparently young children, and the husband had a very serious illness and would probably die within a certain amount of time. And he was the breadwinner and making the living for the family. So what kind of provisions would be made in a situation like that?
Do you want to take this one?
Sure.
Thank you.
Chairwoman Tomei and members of the committee.
Your name, please.
Dale Mirande.
Thank you, Dale.
And the federal government has prescribed
how we look at a client situation when they apply for Medicaid benefits. And what they allow us to do is they allow us to split income and resources so that the non-institutionalized spouse, the community spouse, has income available. And, for instance, if you had a client who had, let's say the community spouse hadn't worked, but they have some SSDI, some retirement money. So they would have, $700 or $800 in SSDI. And the other person, the person who needed care, the institutionalized spouse, had $4,000 or $5,000 in retirement coming in. Then we would look at the needs of the community spouse, and as required by law, we go down a list and we allow deductions off of that income for the institutionalized spouse. We finally come down to how big a need can that spouse in the community have. And as Deanna mentioned, we start with $1,750, of which $525 of that is shelter. Let's say that they had a $2,500 mortgage. Okay, $525 is not going to cover that mortgage. So what the case manager does, and this doesn't even come to us, this is what the case manager can do. They can actually take the resources that the couple has, and say they have $300,000 in resources. And right now, I think we're using 1% for a CD rate. So we would take... say up to $300,000 of those resources over to the community spouse, earning 1%, and that's going to give her $300 a month. So we'd keep moving resources over after we moved income over. So we're doing income first. So if he has the money coming in, we're going to move his income over to make sure that she can cover her mortgage. She doesn't have to move out. She doesn't have to get a divorce because that's provided for in the rules as they exist already. The problem we have with not doing income first is several things. First of all, the couple could possibly keep community spouse in the style to which the federal government thinks she should be accustomed right off the bat without doing anything else. But if he doesn't have the income, we can move the resources over so she does have the money to stay in her own home. You don't have to get divorced. You don't have to move out of your home. Now, the problem here is the large income, the $5,000 or $6,000 a month, say, that this person has coming in. Going on Medicaid can be a painful experience for people. What we're allowed to do is look at the couple as they exist. What we're not allowed to do is say, this person may die in 5 years. So we're going to pile up even more money over here for a later time. We're just not allowed to do that by policy. We have to look at the couple as they come to us. And we will do everything within what the federal guidelines give us to allow her to have enough money to stay in that home. Does that help at all?
It helps some. I feel badly that we've lost so many of our members, and I think this is an issue we might want to spend more time on. Representative Huffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's basically what I was going to say because I have to get to a meeting. But I'm anxious to hear more on this. It's a very complicated subject because you're mixing state and federal together, and it's so easy because so many situations are different. There can be similarities, but you can be comparing apples and oranges so easily. But I have had situations this past year where one spouse was ill and entered home, and to go with them, the surviving spouse lost her home, and then after the ill spouse passed away, then she had to go find a kid to live with. And another situation that I got Karen involved in, and Karen didn't recommend it, but it was recommended this couple, I think through a caseworker, that their best scenario would be to get a divorce. And I think that's criminal that we would have to put people in that situation. Thank you.
Thank you, and I think we will revisit this. So thank you very much for coming today, all of you, and bringing this bill to us. With that, I will close the public hearing on 3392, and I will see you all at 8:30 on Monday morning. We'll close the House Committee on Human Services.